This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
We are fortunate to have with us this evening a speaker who not only is an insightful analyst of presidential politics, but also an accomplished historian. Evan Thomas is a graduate of Harvard and the University of Virginia Law School. But instead of pursuing law, he decided to pursue journalism. That was after a summer stint, at the Bergen Record in New Jersey. He ultimately, as you know, has become editor at large for Newsweek magazine, where he has written more than 100 cover stories and won a National Magazine Award for General Excellence for Newsweek's coverage of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It is said that journalism is the first rough draft of history. But Evan Thomas has not settled for the rough draft. He has written 6 authoritative books on American history, including The Wise Men, a landmark examination of some of the most influential figures of the Cold War era, and most recently, Sea of Thunder, an account of the World War II naval battle of Leyte Gulf. Now, this is a particularly important contribution to our historical understanding, I think, because this book really, by Evan pouring through diaries and other personal accounts, brought to life the often misunderstood views of the senior Japanese military leaders. Tonight, though, our speaker will put his considerable historical and journalistic experience to work for us in an examination of the 2008 race for the White House. Ladies and gentlemen, Evan Thomas.
Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be here. This is my wife Osi's home state, and we arrived last night, and we were driving in the dark by some what to look to me just normal warehouses, and she said, oh, to be back in California. Self-confidence is a wonderful thing, but it is possible to have too much of a wonderful thing. I'm going to read. This is a transcript of a radio conversation between a British naval ship off the coast of Kerry, Ireland, and the Irish Coast Guard in October 1995. The transcript was released by the Chief of Naval Operations. Irish, please divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. British, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Irish, negative. You will have to divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. British, this is the captain of a British Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. Irish, negative. I say again, you will have to divert your course. British, this is the aircraft carrier HMS Britannia, the second largest ship in the British Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and numerous support vessels. Demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. I say again, that is 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of this ship. Irish, we are a lighthouse. Your call. Now, think of all the trouble. Think of all the trouble. That overconfidence and arrogance, and as the ancients used to say, hubris, all the trouble that's caused people and nations. Empires have risen and fallen on hubris alone. It was interesting to me that in the Roman Republic, when a conquering general came back into Rome, entered Rome, they would put a slave in the chariot with him to whisper in his ear, remember, you too are mortal. Nonetheless, the Roman Republic became the Roman Empire, and inevitably it fell. I think that's a challenge for us, that's a challenge for the United States, is how to avoid that kind of hubris, that kind of overconfidence. I think so much depends on our leadership and depends on their humility, and that's what I want to talk to you about tonight. I'm writing about this now. I'm writing what I think is a cover story from Newsweek on this subject, so this is a little bit of a work in progress. I hope you bear with me as I try to think through this problem with you. Obviously, it's too simple to say that, well, all you need to be is humble and everything will be great. I don't mean that. I know it's more complicated than that. But I think you have to think about the nature of confidence. To me, people who are arrogant are typically not confident. They're insecure. In fact, the more cocky somebody is, the more I suspect that they're actually, underneath that, insecure. And at the same time, it seems to me that people who are truly confident are humble, that confidence breeds a kind of humility that is essential to self-knowledge. Now, nobody wants to be totally honest with yourself. I don't know about you, but everybody has a movie playing in their head. I have a movie playing in my head, and you always want to brush over the imperfections and remember the unfortunate things you've done and sort of smooth those bad relationships that you had and forget about the past that was mediocre or bad and think about a brighter future. It's just inevitable that we need to see ourselves this way. And if that's true of regular people, think of what it is for politicians who have to get up every morning and sell some kind of vision, often a grand vision, morning in America or a bridge to a 21st century or a New Deal or a new frontier, who have to present themselves in mythic terms as the man from hope or born in a log cabin or to talk softly and carry a big stick. Now, there's always been some hooey involved in all this. Teddy Roosevelt did not talk softly at all. He brayed like a donkey. But people listened to him, and they respected him. Now, voters want to believe. Regular Americans want to believe in heroic narratives. They want to believe a storyline that is mythic. So there is a disposition for us to look for heroes and imbue our leaders with heroic qualities. At the same time, there is voters have a sense of what the comedian Stephen Colbert calls truthiness. They know it when people are phonies. They can sense it and smell it. Even voters who aren't paying all that much attention to politics can look at a politician on TV and just sense when they're not really telling the truth or deeper than that, true to themselves. Now, I think that people really care about this. They want leaders who are self-aware, who know themselves, who are confident enough to be humble, who don't fool themselves. And I think Exhibit A is our recent experience with President Bush. Now, after 9/11, I think Bush did marvelous things in this country to show resolution and to show self-confidence at a time when we were afraid. I was afraid, certainly, and I think a lot of Americans were afraid. Bush, I think, deserves tremendous credit for his ability to project the kind of resoluteness that we needed. But it appears that he engaged in what a colleague of mine was calling today a faith-based presidency, not just faith in God, he certainly has that, but you had to have faith in George Bush. He was basically saying to us, look, believe in me, have faith in me, and things are going to work out. I'll take care of you. And many of us did, but it was a little bit too faith-based and not fact-based. Bush had an exceptional degree, he ignored inconvenient facts, and he ignored unpleasant advice, and he just whisked aside anybody who disagreed with him. Now, as I'm going to get to, all presidents do this, but Bush did it to a remarkable degree, and along the way, we lost faith in him. At least judging by the polls, more than two-thirds of the country just doesn't really believe him anymore. And more than that, when bad things happen, not just in Iraq, but in Katrina and more recently with the economy, they're wondering, does this guy really know what he's doing? And it is really a serious thing for a president to have that kind of loss of faith. It's really damaging to the presidency and damaging to the country. I'm fascinated by how this happens, this process, how presidents sort of lose the sense of who they are, how they become hubristic. And the story that always comes to me was told to me years ago by Bob Strauss, who was a famous lawyer lobbyist in town and an advisor to many presidents. And he described this process of people coming to the Oval Office. And he said outside the Oval Office when he was standing there, they would say to him, some of these guys, men would say to him, I'm going to tell that dumb son of a bitch a thing or two. And then they'd get in the Oval Office and they'd say, oh, Mr. President, you're doing such a wonderful job. And that's just the nature of the office. It defangs the most severe critic. People are awed by it. I've been there a few times, and it does have an awe-inspiring effect on you. You cannot help but feel a reverence for the office and by transference on the individual there, really no matter who he is. And it has the effect of producing sycophants and yes-men. Presidents always have a fair number of these. Bush had them to an extraordinary degree. Now, it is true there are some strong personalities around, but there were not a lot of skeptics or doubters in there. He lived essentially and has lived, not so much recently, but certainly for the first 6 years, in a bubble where he just wasn't hearing contrary advice. I really fault in this his national security advisor in the first term, Condoleezza Rice, whose job it is to present bad news to the president. Her job as national security advisor is to bring varied opinions to the president and make sure he's aware of bad news and contrariness and questions, and that he thinks through those questions. And she didn't do that. There's by any number of sources we know now that she was much more of a confidant than an advisor. She was there to give expression to his views, but not really to tell him anything that he didn't want to hear. Bush basically, after a while, didn't have any, on the domestic side, any advisors except for Karl Rove, who was his political advisor. You probably can't even name Bush's domestic policy advisors. To me, the nadir came when, in fact, I'll bet you this is a name a few of you have ever heard. Bush's senior domestic policy advisor in the winter of 2006 was a man named Claude Allen. He was arrested for stealing TV sets at the mall and plea bargained. Now, you know, the great presidents fight against this instinct to surround yourself with yes men, all the way back to George Washington, whose personal secretary pushed him to include in the very first cabinet Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of Treasury and Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State, which is significant not just because they were great men, but because those men absolutely hated each other and had diametrically opposite views of what government should do. Hamilton believed in strong federal government, Jefferson in weak government. Washington was smart enough to have those people in his cabinet and to tolerate and even encourage this difference. Abraham Lincoln, I'm sure some of you at least have read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. Lincoln intentionally brought in people who disagreed with him, not just anybody, but powerful people who disagreed with him. And he had this quality that I wish I had, but the great ones have. He didn't let them get his goat. Lincoln had this great ability, although he had a temper, and he was a passionate man, and he was very funny, but he had this ability not to let people bait him. He didn't lash out. He had a way of not mailing that letter right away, but waiting for the next day, controlling his temper, which allowed him, since he didn't lash out at people, to hear a variety of views. And it was critically important to him making the considered judgments that he did. Franklin Roosevelt famously had all sorts of rivalrous aides beneath him who were constantly fighting with each other. Now, yes, it's true that helped Roosevelt be in charge. He could kind of float above while his aides kind of cut each other up. But it wasn't just a power thing. There's a famous story of a scene in which George Marshall, who was then a brigadier general, a one-star general, came to see the president in 1938 and said to President Roosevelt that his plans for a military buildup were completely wrong. Now, the people in the Oval Office with it watched this one-star general and thought his career was over. Roosevelt made him Army Chief of Staff. And, as you know, he became the organizer of victory in World War II. He was willing to listen to highly critical advice, and if he thought it was right, he would take it. And he was unashamed of that. The good presidents sometimes start off not listening to advice, but they learn. My favorite example of this is John F. Kennedy, who was a cocky young man when he became president. And when he got to Washington, got to the Oval Office, he had a view of Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's national security staff, as being bureaucratic and sclerotic and too many aides shuffling paper. And Kennedy was much cooler than that. He didn't need all that. He liked talking to these guys at the CIA. There was a famous dinner a couple of weeks before he was inaugurated between the top men in the White House and the top men at the CIA at the Alibi Club in Washington. And Richard Bissell, who was the chief of operations at the CIA, said, "I'm your basic man-eating shark." And everybody laughed and had a martini. And the next thing they did was the Bay of Pigs. As you know, that was the failed invasion of Cuba by a CIA-backed force. It was utter folly. It was a fiasco. It really hurt America in the world. It was a shock to Kennedy. In fact, he threatened at the time to break up the CIA in 1,000 pieces. Some people wish that he had. But he learned from it. He learned from the mistake. And he created a structure. He realized he had to have structure. He realized he had to have contrary advice. He created a structure. And the next time there was a big crisis involving Cuba, and it was a really big crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviets put missiles inside Cuba, Kennedy created something called the XCOM, a group of 20 senior statesmen, some out of government, some in government. They had a marvelous argument for 13 days. It was able to produce a subtle, clever response. They started off talking very heroically about bombing Cuba, but by the time they were done, they were able to work out a face-saving plan for the Russians whereby both sides would withdraw their missiles. And they had essentially made a secret deal. It took a great deal of argument, pro and con, to do that, with people fiercely arguing on both sides. Kennedy was able to sit there and listen to it and take it in and reach the right result. Kennedy learned from his earlier arrogance. He was no longer the cocky young man that he had been just 18 months before. Ronald Reagan is another example of somebody who had this capacity to listen and to learn and was burned by it, but learned from it. Initially, when he came in, obviously he had great vision and a great sense of the myth-making potential of American history and all that, but he was smart enough to have very shrewd advisors. He had a chief of staff named James A. Baker, who was very smart, I'm looking for a glass of water here, very smart and tough. Now, in his second term, Baker went off to be Treasury Secretary, and a fellow named Oliver North, many of you may remember, came in and essentially ran amok and led Reagan into the Iran-Contra scandal, this nutty deal whereby we tried to trade arms for hostages in Iran and use some of the money to illegally pay for arms to the Contras in South America. It was a harebrained scheme cooked up by a lieutenant colonel. It never should have happened. Reagan learned from it. Everybody thought Reagan's presidency was basically finished by Iran-Contra, but it wasn't. He continued to do the essential work of ending the Cold War with the Soviet Union. He brought in people to clean up the mess, and he was no young chicken at the time. Reagan was able, late in his presidency, to learn from his mistakes and to not repeat them. I think President Bush's father had a similar capacity. He foolishly promised at the 1988 Republican convention, read my lips, no new taxes, and then, of course, had to change his mind. He was persuaded to do it by his advisors because it was necessary. The deal they cooked in 1990, I think it was, that budget deal, actually set the stage for a decade of economic growth. It was a responsible thing to do. It cost Bush politically. He paid a price for it. Arguably, he was not reelected president because he violated that pledge. But it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do. He listened to contrary advice, and he changed his mind at his own political cost, but for the good of the country. I can go on with these historical examples, but let me pitch into the future here. I want to look at the current group of candidates and see, try to guess at which one of them has some self-awareness, has the potential at least for humility, for listening to contrary advice. Now, this is hard to do. Any of you who have watched these debates, you can't, it's very hard to learn much about a candidate during an election. They're dominated by their pollsters and their consultants, and they stick to their talking points. It really is frustrating, for me at least, to watch a presidential debate, to really figure out what they're really like when they're blabbering away from their talking points. But I'm going to try here, because I think it is an essential exercise for all of us. To me, more important than their positions on the issues is my own sense of their character. I mean, character really does out in the end, but especially in the presidency. That, to me, is the essential question. So let me just run through the candidates here. Hillary Clinton. I'm going to do this a little bit in terms of how they see the movie in their minds, how they see their own myth. That the story that she's selling is essentially restoration. It's the restoration of the good years of the Clintons in the 90s. She's selling experience that she's been there before. There is a kind of reassuring quality to her talking about her experience, kind of come to mama, you know, I can solve these problems. And there are times when I feel reassured by that. She has been around the track. But as Obama said, as he said sort of sarcastically, I don't remember, he said, I don't remember when you were Secretary of Treasury, Hillary. She was never in a cabinet. She was always the president's wife. She saw a lot, but, you know, it's not the same thing as actually being in charge. And I'm influenced by a book by a friend of mine named Sally Bedell Smith called For Love of Politics that paints a pretty harsh view of the Clinton White House in the 90s. Hillary doesn't seem tough-minded and calm and steady and the experienced one. She seems rather strident, paranoid, secretive, and caught in this miserable marriage that is full of all sorts of imbalances. She has moral superiority on her husband, but he's sort of better at everything than she is. And there's a tortured quality to it that isn't going away. If she's elected, you don't just get her, you get him. And to many people, that's a good thing, because many people believe he was an effective president and a great leader, and he certainly is a great talker, and he has many, many qualities. But he would be the unelected co-president and unconfirmed Secretary of State and unconfirmed Secretary of the Treasury. And what you're really getting when you get the Clintons is a, to me, long-lasting but not terribly functional marriage, and that makes me uneasy. Now, Barack Obama makes me uneasy for different reasons. He is he's offering a renewal of hope, and I find that terribly appealing, especially at a time when we're all feeling a little down and not so hopeful. But there's something slightly vague about his visions, and also a little bit grandiose that he's going to come and unite us and solve everything. I think he is capable of self-awareness. My wife, Osteen, and I have been listening to a tape of his autobiography, and there is unusual self-awareness in it. It's certainly at times. He actually wrote the thing himself. That makes him unusual. He didn't have a ghostwriter. All of that encourages me, but without question, Barack Obama would be a roll of the dice. John Edwards is selling a dream, all right. It's a populist dream, a dream of the revenge of the common man. I think it's sincere in the sense that Edwards remembers being the son of a mill worker, and he bears a certain chip on his shoulder against the rich folks. But there is a slick and slippery quality to Edwards. He does remind me of a trial lawyer who's good at making juries cry. There's a vanity about him that I find a little bit off-putting. Yes, this populist message has some power, but it has never gotten in this country to 51% before. William Jennings Bryan tried it in 1896, and people have tried variations on it ever since. It's never gotten to 51%. I don't think it's going to get there with John Edwards. I don't think he's going to get the nomination, for starters. And I think it's partly because people just sense in him a kind of slickness that is off-putting, that there's just a little bit too much of a hustle in him. And I share that view. On the Republican side, Rudy Giuliani, we've all seen that movie. It's a Jerry Bruckheimer thriller. 9/11 was, that was a great moment for him, at least as a public presence. And in a terrifying age, that can be a great quality, this ability to reassure and to seem heroic when you're covered with dust. But again, closer scrutiny makes me less confident. He has a way to sort of bluff and deny when his critics come close. He's famous in New York for being surrounded by aides who are known as Yes Rudies. He likes sycophants. And even his performance at 9/11 has recently had a rough time. And why didn't the cops and firemen have radios that could speak to each other? Why did Giuliani choose to put the New York City Emergency Crisis Center in a known terrorist target on the 20th floor of the World Trade Center? So Giuliani, his heroic image, has some cracks in it. And I think those are real cracks. I don't think that's just press carping. I think there are real questions about how truly confident he is. There is a slight, there's a bit of the demagogue in him, a bit of the bully, that I attribute not so much to confidence as to unconfidence. Mitt Romney is offering himself as a kind of Mr. Fix-It, and there's a sort of pleasing non-ideological quality to Romney. I mean, he's just going to get in there and fix things. But he also, this is not a movie, it's a TV show. At least some of you are old enough to remember the TV show Leave It to Beaver. He reminds me of Eddie Haskell. There's a kind of unctuousness to him. He's a pleaser. He's a little bit too eager to please, and he hasn't just shaded his positions. He's flip-flopped on gay rights, on abortion rights. He's just a little too eager to please. I was appalled by him. It worked in Michigan, but he's saying to these auto workers, oh, I'm going to get your jobs back. I'm going to protect you. At least the guy who lost, John McCain, had the honesty to say, those jobs are gone. They're not coming back. We need to retrain you, and we need to care for you and care for the people who have been left behind. But I'd be lying to you if I said I was going to get those jobs back. And I think Romney did lie, and it worked. Which happens sometimes in politics, he won. Huckabee has been in sales all his life, has a savor of souls. Now, he's not, might say, well, Elmer Gantry, another, fake preacher. There's something appealing about Huckabee. He's not sanctimonious in a way. He doesn't have that saccharine quality you sometimes see in evangelist preachers. He's not bombastic. He really is a very charming guy, but I don't 100% trust him. I mean, he hired Ed Rollins, one of the real killer Ed Rollins, who long time basically a political hitman, smart and tough, but a real negative campaigner. Huckabee hires him to run his campaign, and Rollins makes these negative ads, and suddenly Huckabee has this attack of conscience. And he says, well, we're not going to run those ads. But he brings in newsmen, newspeople, and he shows them the ad to prove that this is the ad that he's not running, guaranteeing that it's all over YouTube and everywhere else. You know, how cute is that? It's a little too cute. And you wonder really what he was thinking and what he really was doing, and maybe it was whether he was even cahoots with Rollins to go through this whole charade. Now, John McCain, by the low bar I've just set here, does have more integrity, I think, than most of these. His movie was true. He really was a prisoner of war for 5.5 years and suffered in ways that we can't imagine. And he persevered through that. And it made him a very stoic figure. And also, I detect at times a very forgiving figure. He has the capacity, an unusual capacity, to forgive, the kind of forgiveness that only real suffering can bring about. But he's a bit of a hothead. He's got a temper. I've seen it. I know a lot of senators who have saved up letters of apology from John McCain for his outbursts of temper. He's flirted with pandering. I mean, he almost doomed his candidacy at the outset by trying to inherit Bush's mantle as the leader of the party. And he did pander to the religious right about a little over a year ago, and it cost him. To his credit, when his campaign was about out of money, he sort of found his voice again and got back on the Straight Talk Express and has been, relatively speaking, more straightforward, I think, more honest, more willing to tell the truth. But again, I'm troubled by that edge that he's got. You do sense a little bit of seething in him and a kind of willfulness. I spoke to Brent Scowcroft, who's sort of one of these wise men of Washington, about a week ago, and who advises McCain, and he said something that bothered me, which was that he was not so sure that in a real crisis, if McCain had a strong instinct, he'd listen to contrary advice, and that gives me pause. Now, it's easy to do what I've just done, which is for a journalist to pick through the flaws of everybody who's is running. It's a little presumptuous on my part. And I'm reminded that we did this with Al Gore in 2000 unfairly. I mean, you may recall that we went after Gore for saying that he was the model for the Kirov love story and that he invented the internet and all that. There's been recent reporting that shows that those claims were exaggerated by us, by the press, that Gore really was badly treated by the press in 2000, that we exaggerated his exaggerations. And I think that that is a risk. We journalists do play gotcha. And it's, you know, none of us could withstand the kind of scrutiny that politicians get. And no wonder, once they get in the Oval Office, they want to have nothing to do with the press. They want to pour boiling oil on the press room. I would feel that way if I was surrounded by the jackals of the press. And yet, these are all people running for president have to go through this kind of scrutiny. We need to do this because these questions of character are so very important. And we have to ask not only that these folks, I think, are self-aware and honest with themselves, but that they actively promise to reach out and seek contrary advice. We live in this partisan age where everybody's always right and their enemies are always wrong. And in Washington especially, there is so little true bipartisanship. There is become so polarized, even in the years that I've been doing this. OC and I got to Washington in 1979, I think it was, so that's not quite 30 years ago. It was a tamer place. It was a sweeter place, believe it or not. And not that there hadn't, I mean, Washington has a long history of partisanship, but just in the 30 years I've been there, it has noticeably worsened and become more harsh. And so I think the next president has to reach out and promise to reach out and do it in concrete ways. There's a man in Washington called David Abshire who runs a place called the Center for the Study of the Presidency, and he has, I think, what's a good idea, what he calls a unity cabinet, which is that the next president promise and choose two senior cabinet people from the opposite party as a show of, hey, I'm serious about bipartisanship. I'm going to bring the other side into my tent and share with them. I think this is a good idea. I don't think it's a foolproof idea. After all, presidents can ignore their cabinet secretaries. Just ask Colin Powell how much FaceTime he got with George Bush when it was clear that Powell was against him. Shockingly little, actually. So it's not a perfect solution, but it is a step. And I think that, the good presidents do take these steps. They seek out opposing views. You don't have to be showy about it. One thing that I loved about Truman was his modesty, that arguably the best thing Truman ever did was the plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. Truman said, don't name that after me. They named it after the sainted General Marshall. It became the Marshall Plan. It wasn't really Marshall's plan. It was Truman's plan or Dean Acheson's plan. But Truman had the good sense to name it after somebody else. You see that kind of low-key modesty in the great ones. Eisenhower was considered to be sort of a dull figure, and a kind of cautious figure. But it turns out that behind the scenes, he was not. When he first came into office, he convened something called the Solarium Project, named after the solarium, the room in the White House where this group met. And he brought in the best thinkers on foreign policy, and he turned them into three teams, each proposing different approaches to handling the Soviet Union, the communist threat. And he just had them argue for 3 days. And it was noticed that at the end of that 3 days, the person who was best able to summarize what they had said was the person that everybody thought was sort of inarticulate. It was Dwight Eisenhower. The press never knew about this. This was never advertised. Eisenhower sort of would fumble through press conferences, and the reporters would have to clean up his syntax. But behind the scenes, he was clear as a bell and able to handle tremendously contrary advice. To me, that is a model, that you bring somebody, you bring in people who might disagree, and you actually listen. So let me just end up here with some things that I think a president has got to have. Yes, he's got to have vision. We know that. Yes, president has to be decisive. You can't just dither around as you listen to all these opposing points of view. And yes, they have to be confident, but they must be confident enough to be truly humble. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions about this and any and all things that on politics or anything you want. I get paid to know a little about a lot.
My question is concerning Mayor Bloomberg's possible independent candidate presidential bid, and also his aides believing that Ross Perot's 19% in 1992 is just the floor, not the ceiling, of what an independent candidate can gather.
I'm intrigued by Bloomberg. look, conventional wisdom is that third parties can't win the presidency because no third party ever has. Ross Perot got 19%. That's a high watermark. But Bloomberg is different. He's, for one thing, he's got $1 billion to spend. Nobody else. My grandfather, Norman Thomas, ran for the presidency six times from 1932 to 1948, and I'm sure they never spent more than $1,000 on campaign posters. Bloomberg is different. And I think he may actually get in if the Republicans nominate Giuliani and the Democrats nominate Hillary Clinton, both of whom he cannot stand. I think there's a good chance he will get in the race. He's got a whole apparat going. He's got an advisor who's known as the deputy mayor for running for president. He's willing to spend the dough. And he's pretty out there. In fact, so out there that people are kind of tired of it in New York City. There was a kind of a snarky article in the New York Times about a week ago saying, come on, you know, Fisher cut bait. He won't Fisher cut bait until March when we have a clearer idea. But I think, I'll make a prediction, that if Giuliani and Hillary are nominated and there is a kind of sense of disquiet in the country about it, he will get in. Now, could he win? He's got to get on every state ballot, or almost all of them. I think that's doable. I would say a cautious bet would say that he's more likely to throw the election into the House, which would elect Hillary, because it's probably going to be a Democratic Congress. And the way it works, nobody gets the required number of electoral votes, goes into the House, they vote by state delegation, and the Democrats would win. So it would have the effect of electing Hillary. It would give Bloomberg an enormous IOU. In fact, there's some talk that he's dancing around trying to leverage himself to be maybe a vice president with control over the domestic economy or some political play like that. It's going to be a fun thing to watch.
I have a question concerning Al Gore in relation to the other candidates that you mentioned, even though Al's not a candidate. I was in a hotel restaurant in Palo Alto after a USC-Stanford game and had a casual conversation with another diner. Right. And it turned out that this gentleman made television advertisements for the Democratic National Committee. And this goes back a number of years before the election with Al Gore. And I said to him, well, you know Al Gore, or do you know Al Gore, and tell me about him. He says, yes, I know him. He's arrogant. And how would you place him among the others that you mentioned, if, of course, you've had some experience with him?
I actually have a lot of experience with Al Gore because we're close in age, and when I was covering Congress in the early 80s, he was a congressman, and my wife and I had dinner with him and his wife a couple of times, and I found him a perplexing character. Personally, when I first met him, I was charmed by him. He was outrageously funny. He wasn't stuffy and awkward and all that. He was just a great guy. I remember calling my mother up, who was a professional liberal, and said, hey, Mom, I got the candidate for you, Al Gore. But then I covered him in 88 when he was running for the president, and he was a terrible candidate. I remember being in a small room in New Hampshire, and he was bellowing at the top of his lungs. And I sort of felt, whoa, why are you doing that? Where's the Al Gore I had dinner with 4 years ago? He was a very bad candidate for reasons I never really understood. He was much better in private and in person than he was on the stump. I think he's a sort of tragic figure is too strong a word, but possibly. I mean, consider what kind of President Bush has been. Maybe it is a tragedy that Gore didn't. Because Gore did win in 2000, but he didn't get the electoral votes. I really, really admire his stance on global warming, and I think he deserved that Nobel Prize. I think he's been an admirable public servant in that way. He really has done the world a lot of good. I think there's about a 2% chance he might actually get in the race. 2% chance, 3% chance, but not totally impossible. He's a funny figure because he's a much better person than he was as a candidate. He just didn't show well. He seemed pompous and stiff and just a lousy candidate, although I think a good person.
I get a sense from your talk that you're really not very happy with the options that we have for presidency.
You could say that.
And
I should have titled this talk none of the above.
And my question really, I hope, will not put you on the spot. Who do you think, personally, would be the best person to be our president?
Yeah. Well, it's a fair question. I can tell you who I'm drawn to.
Obama on the Democratic side, because I do, there's something about Obama that the image he would present to the world would confound our enemies. If the United States elects a black man president of the United States, right away you have this impact around the world without him ever opening his mouth. It's just going to confuse our enemies that we could do this. And there is a kind of hopefulness about him and articulateness about him. His own story is a fascinating story, personal story, of being this confused black kid in Hawaii, surrounded by whites and Hawaiians, and trying to, how do I fit in here? And, you know, his finding his way is a kind of a great American story. My reluctance with him really is experience. He was a state legislator in Illinois. He's been in the Senate for 2 years. I mean, what do we really know about him? So that makes me uncomfortable. And, you know, Hillary is a formidable political person. She really has been around the track. On the Republican side, I think I've signaled this. I'm drawn to McCain. I know him. He's a delightful person. He's old, but he is one tough old dude. I spent 24 hours with him, or 18 hours with him, about a year and a half ago. And he's one of those guys, he can stay up all night, drink you under the table. Nothing rattles him. He just has that DNA that just, and I think this was true before he was a prisoner of war when they were beating the hell out of him. I mean, I think he was that way as a 14-year-old. But he has extraordinary will and energy. And there is something admirable about his directness and forthrightness. But his hot-headedness scares me. Now, I wrote a story about McCain when he was doing well in 2000, a sort of contrarian story. The headline was Senator Hothead. And McCain, a lot of politicians said, oh, they wouldn't speak to me for days after that. McCain's attitude was, yeah, you're right. Me is his disarming quality, which I really enjoy and like. But the hothead part worries me. I mean, you know, I'm afraid he'd invade Iran or do something really hot-headed. He has this aura about him of I've suffered like nobody's ever suffered. I've got nothing to lose. And that's kind of an appealing quality, but it's also a slightly frightening quality.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yeah.
If it's now Obama and McCain and Bloomberg enter the picture, who would you vote for?
Well, fair enough. I don't know. I'd have to argue with my wife for a while. My kids, I often make a deal with my... I've made a deal with my kids in the past. I've been so unsure that if they can persuade me to vote for X, I'll vote for them because I'm not really sure myself. So I might make the same deal. Bloomberg is a pretty competent mayor of New York, but from all accounts I get, and we need a fix-it. We need somebody who can run government and make things work. I mean, Washington is dysfunctional, and Bloomberg is a nonpartisan, bipartisan fixer type, and I find that enormously appealing. He's tremendously smart. He doesn't know anybody anything. Those are all admirable qualities. I think he's a little arrogant, but, you know, as I've been saying in my speech, there's good arrogance and bad arrogance. I think he's generally, in some ways, many truly confident guy. So I would be drawn to him. I'd sure give him a good look if he got in. Yeah.
In covering the election, you mentioned that the press has to put their emphasis on candidates to have a chance of winning. I believe the press has the same selective approach, not only when it comes to covering elections, but addressing policies and political and social issues, whether domestically or in terms of foreign policy. As a member of the media elite, don't you think it's your responsibility to inform the American people about the real issues, about the root causes of problems, particularly in terms of foreign policy, because that's very prominent now, this day and age. For example, in one of the previous debates, Ron Paul, he made some fine points about the root causes of Islamic extremism and why there are jihadists and terrorists. However, the other candidates cast him aside as if he's just clueless and that he's just naive about this.
What were those points?
His point was that you need to look at why people would become extremists, right? Because terrorism is a tactic. It's not an ideology. His main point was that these people do not become extremists because they don't like freedom, or they don't like that how in America you don't have to cover your hair. They're angry because the U.S. foreign policy is very hypocritical because of past U.S. involvement, not only in the Middle East, throughout the world, about U.S. arrogance when it comes to dealing with other nations, and it's basically U.S. hegemony. So, and their support, and their relentless support for Israel and many other issues. When he was talking about these issues, the other candidates just looked at him like, oh, like Ron Paul is very naive, and that basically he's clueless about that. They basically portrayed him as if he was elected to president, these other extremists, they would take over America, and basically America would become weak. So my question for you is, don't you think it's more of a responsibility for your, not yourself, but the media as a whole, to cover the real issues, the root causes, rather than the person who has a better chance of winning?
I think all the issues that Ron Paul raised, Newsweek has covered extensively. If you read Newsweek, just to take one magazine, Fareed Zakaria.
I meant the media as a whole.
Fareed Zakaria writes about the very things you're talking about all the time. I think we make a real effort, and other so-called media elites make a big effort to figure out the roots of terrorism. I think it's we were obsessed with it after 9/11. Zakaria wrote a cover story 3 weeks after 9/11 called Why They Hate Us that went into all of these issues, American hegemony, overbearing qualities of American foreign policy, the Israel question. All of these issues get dealt with by this so-called media elite. Just because we don't cover Ron Paul doesn't mean we don't cover these issues.
That was an example.
We do.
But we do. We cover these issues.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier the responsibility of reporters and the press to inform the electorate as to, you know, abilities of candidates and such. Not too many years ago, television had zero influence in the election process. Today it has a much more significant influence. I wonder if you have a feeling about that. Was it better before? Are there ways that the press could diminish the influence of television in the electoral process today?
Well, there's a tendency to look at the good old days. I succumb to this all the time, but I'm always reminded, if you look at the election of 1800, it was a slime fest. I love it that, Thomas Jefferson hired a hack journalist to smear John Adams, and then the hack journalist got back at Jefferson when he was bought by the other side, spreading the rumors about Sally Hemings. This is in 1800. Our greatest of statesmen. So negative campaigning, dirty tricks, nothing new there. The press has been irresponsible for centuries. On TV, TV's been a mixed bag. I think when there were just three networks, there was actually a moderating effect. When the whole country had to watch, or did watch, three networks, it 1971, if you turn... Half of all the TVs in the United States were tuned to these three news shows. They were pretty middle of the road. I sort of missed that. Now only 10% of the United States is tuned into these shows, and more people either have left politics altogether, they're watching entertainment or sports or, you know, the Playboy channel, or they're just feeding their parochial partisan interests by going online and getting themselves all stirred up or listening to right-wing talk radio or liberal talk radio. In other words, I kind of miss the moderating effect of the dominance of the old three networks in the days of Walter Cronkite. I think it made for a more middle-of-the-road electorate, and I think that's one of the reasons why we have partisanship now. I wrote about this recently, drawing on an article by a Princeton professor named Marcus Pryor, who pretty much proved this. So TV, I think, mostly had a good effect then. I think now I'm not crazy about all of the talking heads. I think there's the problem with 24-hour cable TV is it's too much airtime chasing too little news. And so it all gets loud and raucous and repetitive. And frankly, I don't watch it. I'm in the news business, but I almost never watch cable TV because I don't really learn anything. But I don't think it's doing any terrible harm because only they have small audiences. I mean, Chris Matthews is only watched by 300,000 people a night. It's, you know, Walter Cronkite used to be watched by 30 million people. And even, you know, the boring Lehrer News Hour, well, that audience is over a million. That's three times Chris's audience. So, you know, there's still some pretty responsible TV out there. And I don't mean to pick on Matthews. I think he's actually a very smart guy. So, I guess the answer is I'm not really bothered by TV news. I don't think it's doing all that much harm. One thing I love about the American media is that we talk about the media, mainstream media, and the media elite. Look, the media is – there's tons of media. I represent a relatively small slice of it. Newsweek has about 3 million readers. There, you know, how many Americans are there? 270 million or whatever it is. There's media for everybody. All of you have computers, and you can go online, and you can find whatever you want. And some of it's really good, and some of it's really bad, and it's everything in between, and it's boring, and it's exciting, and it's lurid, and it's dull, and it's everything. It's an extraordinarily rich stew that's available to any and all of you. And so, really, I don't worry too much about the media. There's whatever you want. It's the marketplace of ideas, and take of it what you will.
Colin Powell, in recent speeches, has said the biggest problem the United States has in the foreign policy arena is arrogance. Extreme arrogance is how he characterizes it. Which of the candidates do you think can do the best job in
diffusing
the U.S. to a position of respect throughout the world? And the second question is, you've commented tonight about, in particular, Al Gore being a great person but a poor campaigner. I think you used the word terrible campaigner.
Right.
How can we as voters and citizens see through the candidates as campaigners and see them as presidents where they have to make decisions and be the executive leader of the country? Thank you.
It's hard. A part of being a president, I mean, it's a little tricky. Part of being a president is being a good campaigner. Part of leadership is that you convey your leadership. So I think it's a flaw of Gore's that he wasn't able to do this. That is part of being a great leader and a president. You have to be a good campaigner. On the question of American arrogance, the person who talks the most about this is Obama. And I think he would help at least confuse, as I said earlier, confound our enemies. I think he cares about this, which is important, and he would make an effort to present a more benign view of the United States, a less hubristic, less arrogant view of the United States around the world. This is a time when we need that. It's not the only qualification for president, but it's an important one. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.